content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, Orwell's Escape. In 1946, the author repaired to the remote Isle of Jura and wrote his masterpiece, 1984. What was he looking for? And this was written by Stephen Metcalf. The Isle of Jura is a patchwork of bogs and moorland laid across a quartzite slab in Scotland's Inner Hebrides, nearly 400 miles from London, rain-lashed, more deer than people. All the reasons not to move there were the reasons George Orwell moved there. Directions to houseguests ran several paragraphs and could include a plane, train, taxis, a ferry, another ferry, then miles and miles on foot down a decrepit, often impassable rural lane. It's safe to say the man wanted to get away. From what? Orwell himself could be sentimental about his longing to escape, thinking always of my island in the Hebrides, he had once written in his wartime diary, or wonderfully blunt. In the aftermath of Hiroshima, he wrote to a friend, "This stupid war is coming off in about 10 to 20 years, and this country will be blown off the map whatever else happens. The only hope is to have a home with a few animals in some place not worth a bomb." It helps also to remember that Orwell's immediate state of mind when he finally fully moved to Jura in May 1946, 4 months before Hiroshima, his wife, Eileen, had died. Shortly after the atomic bomb was dropped, Animal Farm was published. Almost at once, in other words, Orwell had become a widower, terrified by the coming post-war reality, and famous. The latter a condition he seemed to have regarded as nothing but a bother. His newfound sense of dread was only adding to one he'd felt since 1943, when news of the Tehran conference broke. The meeting had been ominous to Orwell. It placed in his head the idea of Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin divvying up the post-war world, leading to a global triopoly of superstates. The man can be forgiven for pouring every ounce of grief of his grief, self-pity, paranoia, and embittered egotism into the predicament of his latest protagonist, Winston Smith. Unsurprisingly, given that it culminated in both his masterpiece and his death, Orwell's time on the island has been picked over by biographers. But Orwell's Island, George, Jura, and 1984, by Les Wilson, treats it as a subject worthy of standalone attention. The book is at odds with our sense of Orwell as an intrepid journalist. It is a portrait of a man jealously guarding his sense of himself as a creature elementally apart, even as he depicts the horrors of a world in which the human capacity for apartness is being hunted down and destroyed. Wilson is a former political journalist, not a critic, who lives on neighboring Islay, famous for its whiskies. He is at pains to show how Orwell on Jura overcame one of his laziest prejudices. The author went from taking every opportunity to laugh at the Scots for their burns, brays, kilts, sporrans, claymores, bagpipes, who better at a derisive list than Orwell, to complaining about the relative lack of Gaelic language radio programming. Scottish had come to mean something more to him than Kailyard Kitsch. These were the people holding out against a fully amalgamated identity, beginning with the Kingdom of Great Britain and extending to modernity itself. On Jura, at least, crofters and fishermen still lived at the village scale. As to whether Jura represented, as it had been suggested, suicide by other means, Orwell was chronically ill, and Barnhill, his cottage, was 25 miles from the island's one doctor. Wilson brushes this aside. In fact, he argues that Jura was kinder to Orwell's ravaged lungs than smog-smothered London, where inhabitants were burning scavenged wood to stay warm. At Barnhill, Orwell set up an almost society in miniature, devoting his 16-acre homestead to his ideal of self-sufficiency. Soon after moving there, he was joined by his sister, his 2-year-old adopted son, and a nanny. Amid the general, often biting austerity of post-war Europe, they enjoyed a private cornucopia, subsisting on, as Wilson says, a diet of fish, lobster, rabbit, venison, and fresh milk and eggs, and were often warmed by peat that Orwell himself had cut. He intended to live there for the rest of his life, raising his son and relishing in existence as a non-cog in a non-capitalist machine. He lived without electricity or phone, shot rabbits for the pot, as Wilson says, raised geese to be slaughtered and plucked, and fished the surrounding waters in a dinghy. He fashioned a tobacco pouch from animal skin and a mustard spoon out of deer bone, and served his aghast guests a seaweed blancmange, over time absconding to Jura and writing 1984, became aspects of a single premonition, a coming world of perpetual engulfment by the forces of bigness. As Orwell's latest biographer D.J. Taylor has pointed out in Orwell, The New Life, Orwell's novels before Animal Farm followed a common template of a sensitive young person going up against a heartless society, destined to lose. Eileen, his wife, is the one who helped him, either by suggesting that Animal Farm be told as a fable, or by lightening his touch, depending on who you talk to find an engaging, even playful in its way, register. The loss of Eileen and return of the self-pitying Orwell alter ego are certainly linked. Indeed, in 1984, he produces his most Orwellian novel in both senses. Only now the protagonist and situation are presented in the absolute extreme. The young man is a bearer, if we believe his tormentor O'Brien, of the last shred of human autonomy in a society both totally corrupt and laying total claim to his being. What this absolutism produced, of course, was not another fusty neo-Edwardian novel, a la Orwell's earlier Keep the Aspidistra Flying, but a wild, aggrieved tour de force of dystopian erotica. Odd though it may sound, given the novel's unremitting torments, 1984 quickly became a bestseller, in no small part because its first readers, especially in America, found it comforting, a source of the release you might feel in a darkened theater when you remember that you yourself are not going to be chased by a man with a chainsaw. The reader would glance up, notice no limitless police powers or kangaroo inquisitions, and say, "We are not them." Such complacency is hard to come by in 2024. Thinking of Orwell, famous though he is for his windowpane prose and the prescience of his essays, as the ultimate sane human being is not so easy either. Rereading 1984 in the light of a Jura episode suggests that Orwell was an altogether weirder person, and his last novel an altogether weirder book than we've appreciated. Conventionally speaking, 1984 is not a good novel. It couldn't be. Novels are about the conflict between an individual's inner generated aims and the prevailing society, social reality that denies or thwarts them. 1984 is the depiction of the collapse of this paradigm, the collapse of inner and outer in all possible iterations. Of course, its protagonist is thinly drawn. Winston's self lacks a social landscape to give it dimensionality. In place of anything like a proper novel, we get a would-be Bildungsroman breaking through to the surface of disparate fragments. These scraps are Winston's yearnings, memories, sensual instincts, which have as yet somehow gone unmurdered by the regime. The entire state-sponsored enterprise of Pavlovian Sadism in Oceania is devoted to snuffing out this remnant interiority. The facsimile of a life that Winston does enact comes courtesy of a series of private spaces, a derelict church, a clearing in the woods, a room above a junk shop, the last of which is revealed to have been a regime-staged contrivance. The inexorable momentum of the novel is toward the final such private space, Winston's last line of defense, and the last line of defense in any totalitarian society, the hidden compartment of his mind. When all else fails, there is the inaccessibility of human mentality to others, a black box in every respect. Uncoincidentally, Winston's final defense, hiding out in his head, had been Orwell's first. While he struggled on Jura to finish 1984, Orwell apparently returned to Such Were the Joys, his long and excoriating essay about his miserable years at St. Cyprian's boarding school. He'd been sent there at the age of 8, one of the shabby, genteel boys with brains, in what was otherwise a class snob's paradise. He was a bedwetter to boot, for which, Orwell writes, he was brutally punished. No wonder he found dignity in apartness. Taylor's biography is brilliant about the connection between Orwell's childhood reminiscence and 1984. In the essay, Orwell portrays his alma mater as an environment that invaded every cranny of its pupils' lives. Against this, he formed a sense of bearing at the middle of one's heart, as he writes, an incorruptible inner self, holding out against an autocratic headmistress. As a cop in Burma, a scullion in Paris, an amateur ethnographer in Northern England, he was a man who kept his own company, even when in company, and whom others, as a consequence, found by and large inscrutable. What was this man's genius, if not taking the petty anxieties of Eric Blair, his given name, and converting them into the moral clarity of George Orwell? Fearful that his own cherished apartness was being co-opted into non-existence, he projected his fear for himself onto something he called the autonomous individual, who, as he said in his 1984 essay, Inside the Whale, is going to be stamped out of existence. To this he added, the literature of liberalism is coming to an end, and the literature of totalitarianism has not yet appeared, and is barely imaginable. As for the writer, he is sitting on a melting iceberg. He is merely an anachronism, a hangover from a bourgeois age, as surely doomed as the hippopotamus. The fate of the autonomous individual, the writer, the literature of liberalism, he carried all of it to Jura, where he dumped it into the head of poor Winston Smith. Orwell typed for hours upstairs, sitting on his iron bedstead in a tatty dressing gown, chain-smoking shag tobacco. In May of 1947, he felt he had a third of the draft, and in November, a completed one. In December, he was in the hospital outside Glasgow, diagnosed with chronic tuberculosis. Not a death sentence, maybe, but his landlord on Jura suspected that Orwell now knew he was dying. The following July, after grueling treatments and a stint in a sanitarium, he returned to Jura fitter, but by no means cured, and under strict orders to take it easy. His rough draft, however, was a riot of scrawled-over pages. To produce a clean manuscript for the publisher, he would need to hire and closely supervise a typist, but no candidate was willing to trek to Jura, and Orwell was unwilling to leave it. He typed 1984 on his own, having all but spent himself writing it. He should have been in bed, Wilson says, but instead he sat propped up on a sofa, banging out 5,000 words a day. Among all of its gruesome set pieces, culminating in Room 101 in the Ministry of Love, the novel's most decisive act of torment is a simple glance in the mirror. Winston is sure, it is one of his last consolations before breaking completely, that some inherent principle exists in the universe to prevent a system based on nothing but cruelty and self-perpetuation, from triumphing forever. O'Brien calmly assures Winston that he's wrong, that he is the last man. And to prove it, and to the obvious non-existence of the human spirit, he forces Winston to look at himself. A bowed, gray-colored, skeleton-like thing was coming towards him. Its actual appearance was frightening, and not merely the fact that he knew it to be himself. He moved closer to the glass. The creature's face seemed to be protruded because of its bent carriage, a forlorn jailbird's face with a knobby forehead running back into a bald scalp, a crooked nose, and a battered-looking cheekbones above which his eyes were fierce and watchful. The cheeks were seamed, the mouth had a drawn-in look. Certainly it was his own face, but it seemed to him that it had changed more than he had changed inside. The emotions it registered would be different from the ones he felt. The final membrane between the inner and outer is dissolving. 1984 can read like Orwell's reverse autobiography, in which, rather than a life being built up, it gets disassembled down to its foundational unit. The body is now wasting. The voice is losing expressive competence. Worse, the face will soon enough have nothing left to express as the last of his adaptive neurocircuitry becomes property of Oceana. 1984 is Orwell saying goodbye to himself, and in an improbably convincing portrait of the erasure of the autonomous individual. He finished typing the novel by early December of 1948. His final diary entry on Jura, dated that Christmas Eve, gave the weight of the Christmas goose before drawing and plucking, then concluded, "Snowdrops up all over the place, a few tulips showing, some wallflowers still trying to flower." The next month he was back in a sanatorium. The next year he was dead. He was 46 years old. 1984 was published 75 years ago. Surprisingly, it immediately surpassed Animal Farm as a critical and commercial success. One by one, Orwell's contemporaries, V.S. Pritchard, Rebecca West, Bertrand Russell, acknowledged its triumph. A rare dissenter was Evelyn Waugh, who wrote to Orwell to say he'd found the book morally inert. "You deny the soul's existence, at least Winston does, and can only contrast matter with reason and will." The trials of its protagonist consequently failed to make Waugh's flesh creep. What he implied was at stake here. Talk about missing the point. Nowhere in Orwell's work can one find evidence of anything essential, much less eternal, that makes us human. That's why Winston, our meager proxy, is available for a thoroughgoing reboot. As the book implies, we're creatures of a contingency all the way down. Even a memory of a memory is of freedom, autonomy, self-making, consciousness, and agency, in a word, of ourselves, can disappear until no loss is felt whatsoever. Hence the terror of being the last man. You're the living terminus, the lone bearer of what will soon enough, a dead language. Waugh wasn't the only muddled reader of the book. In the aftermath of the Berlin blockade and the creation of NATO, followed by the Soviets' detonation of their first atomic weapons, readers, Americans especially, might have been eager for an anti-Stalinist bedtime story. But Orwell had already written an anti-Stalinist bedtime story. If his time on Jura tells us anything, it's that 1984 he was exhorting us to beware of concentrated power and pay attention to public language, yes, but above all, guard your solitude against interlopers, Stalinist or otherwise. In addition to the book's top-down anxieties about the coming managerial overclass, a bottom-up anxiety about how fragile solitude is, irreducible to an abstract right or a material good, permeates 1984. Paradoxically, Winston's efforts to hold fast to the bliss of separateness are what give the book its unexpected turns of beauty and humanity. The sweet summer air played against his cheek, From somewhere far away there floated the faint shouts of children. In a room itself there was no sound except the insect voice of the clock. For all of Orwell's intrepidness, his physical courage, his clarity of expression, his most resolutely anti-fascist instinct lay here, in his terror at the thought of never being alone. After that lengthy book review about George Orwell, let's go to something a little bit lighter, a movie review. A rom-com you might have written. The Idea of You is a modern spin on a Hollywood staple, Someone Famous Falling for Someone Who's Not, by Hannah Georges. As far back as 1953's Roman Holiday, when Audrey Hepburn played a princess who falls for a reporter, Hollywood has drawn on the formula of an asymmetrical romantic union between a celebrity and a regular person. It's an appealing idea. Celebrities are meant to be pined for, and the prospect of being chosen by them must be uniquely validating. That's why much of the fan fiction on sites such as Archive of Our Own, where users write their own lengthy tales riffing on pop culture, falls squarely into the domain of real person fan fiction, or RPF. Such digital spaces may be relatively new, but fantasizing about a celebrity meet-cute isn't. As my colleague Caitlin Tiffany noted, fans have been writing RPF since at least the dawn of Beatlemania. The Idea of You, a new romantic comedy starring Anne Hathaway, is the latest entrant into this genre. Its source material, a 2017 novel by Robin Lee, was inspired partly by the former One Direction singer-songwriter Harry Styles, a pop star with an especially prolific and passionate following. Thankfully, the film is more than a fan fiction fever dream, taking standard rom-com wish fulfillment and dialing it up to unexpectedly charming effect. The gender-flipped Notting Hill kicks into gear when the boy band frontman Hayes Campbell, played by Nicholas Galitzine, tells an amusingly transparent fib. "I have been dying to go to Glendale for the longest time. You have no idea," he says to Solene Hathaway, the Subaru-driving divorcee he meets in a chance mix-up at Coachella. His apparent need to be whisked away to the unglamorous Los Angeles suburb is, of course, really about spending more time with her. After surprising Solene at the gallery she owns and purchasing every piece in her catalog, Hayes cheekily asks her to help him source even more art and jumps at the chance to accompany her to a distant warehouse. The young musician's eagerness to brave L.A. traffic alongside Solene is arguably just as far-fetched as the circumstances of their meeting. But The Idea of You isn't interested in rationalizing the mega-celebrity's affections, instead letting audiences bask in the most charming parts of the fantasy. We watch Hayes listen in awe as Solene speaks with enthusiasm and authority about art. Away from the pandemonium of Coachella, the singer relaxes into the role of observer rather than performer. Their banter is easy and fun. Hathaway's talent for physical comedy shines through and sets up later moments of vulnerability with surprising depth. In Michael Showalter and Jennifer Westfeld's adaptation of the novel, which Showalter also directs, Hayes is 4 years older, and Solene's daughter has aged out of being a superfan of his band. These changes dampen the recklessness of Solene's decision to embark on their romance, making it far easier to enjoy the chemistry between Hathaway, who is 41, and Galitzine, who is 29. Though Hayes is a more underwritten character, both actors bring undeniable tenderness to their roles while also reveling in the kind of charged, witty repartee that modern rom-coms rarely offer. The delight of watching these two lead actors essentially just stand around and talk helps set the idea of you apart from other recent romantic comedies, including Red, White, and Royal Blue, which Galitzine also starred in, and the 2022 J-Lo vehicle Marry Me, which felt like a thinly veiled attempt at dressing up the star's real-life romantic woes. In The Idea of You, however, it's satisfying to see Celine relax into the experience of being desired by a younger man, because the film takes time to show her grappling with mundane grown-up problems, such as an ex-husband who not only cheated on her with a younger woman, but also routinely shirks his parenting duties. The reason Celine meets Hayes is that her ex bailed on their daughter at the last minute, leaving Celine to chaperone a group of teens to a music festival. The Idea of You's attention to Celine's anxieties about motherhood, aging, and public scrutiny helps it feel like more than just an idealized depiction of winning a celebrity's heart. The film is still decidedly earnest, though, which also makes it a welcome departure from They Came Together, the anachronistic rom-com satire that Showalter co-wrote more than a decade ago, and that was released during a particularly rough era for the genre. This one doesn't try to sell its meet-cute as realistic, but the story does feel fully invested in the relationship at its core, not just serving up millennial and Gen Z nostalgia bait by having the one-time Princess of Genovia fall for a Harry Styles avatar. The romance is not cloaked in irony. Neither protagonist is too cool to embarrass themselves in the name of love. Other movies might be adhering to the letter of rom-com law, but The Idea of You really commits to the spirit. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.